Welcome back to In the Active Site, everyone. Our guest today is Professor Nicholas Turner, who is Professor of Chemical Biology in Manchester. He is Director of the Center of Excellence in Biocatalysis and Co-Director of SynBioChem. He received many awards, and since last year, he is also a Fellow of the Royal Society. Furthermore, Nick is a member of the board of the Biotrans conferences, and he also organized a Biotrans back in 2013 in Manchester. Welcome, Nick. I'm excited to have you here.
Hello, and I'm very pleased to be here.
I also want to welcome my colleague and co-host Matthias Pickler. Hi, Matthias. Are you ready for the next episode?
I'm very excited for this episode. Nick, also welcome from my side. It's a very pleasure for us to have you here. I heard that you are a big football fan, and since you are from Manchester, are you from the United people or are you from the City team?
That's a good question. Neither is the answer. My team is Chelsea.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so if you live in Manchester, that's a little difficult because Manchester's split down the middle into light blue and red. But fortunately, I've supported Chelsea since I was a boy, and I have no plans to change.
Very good. You shouldn't. Okay, then we invited you because you were invited to give a talk at the Biotrans 2021. And you have been so many Biotrans. Is there still some excitement left for this upcoming meeting?
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, for obvious reasons, we've all been stuck at home for, well, the last 10 months. And I think we're all desperate to get to conferences now. It was quite nice at the beginning. You know, I went to my last conference in February in the Netherlands. And then when conferences got suspended, that was quite nice. I didn't have to get on a plane. I didn't have to get up early or come back late at night. But that period has passed now. And I sense that people, including myself, want to get back to face-to-face meetings. So when Wolfgang told me that the plan was to have a face-to-face meeting in Graz in July 2021, I thought that was a fantastic idea.
So, Nick, to go through your CV, you did your PhD in 1985 with Professor Sir Jack Baldwin, who is famous in the organic community for the Baldwin rules at the Oxford University. And then you did a postdoc with also a very famous professor, George Whitesides, at the Harvard University. So, Nick, was it in the Whitesides lab where you first worked in the field of biocatalysis? And could you tell us how it was to work on biocatalysis in the 80s?
Well, that's a very good question. It depends what you mean by biocatalysis. I did biocatalysis in my PhD. You know, 1 week after I started, somebody gave me a pot and said there's an enzyme in there. It was an enzyme for making penicillin from the tripeptide precursor. And my supervisor said, your PhD is to use that enzyme to make unnatural penicillin. So that's biocatalysis. But it was sort of more, it was really in the context of biosynthetic pathway understanding. How did the enzyme make these penicillins? So when I went to the Whitesides lab, there the emphasis was much more on using a broad range of enzymes to make intermediates for synthesis, much as we now, you know, recognizes biocatalysis. Has it changed? Oh, absolutely. I tell all my students that biocatalysis has changed out of all recognition in my lifetime. In the 1980s, you didn't really do a lot of protein engineering. You didn't really do a lot of protein expression, cloning. You mainly found enzymes from culture collections, from crude extracts, and you tried to find applications for them. And then in the, you know, the 80s, 90s, this whole field of enzyme evolution, protein engineering, molecular cloning completely took over and changed the whole nature of what we do. So I've seen this field change, you know, out of all recognition in my lifetime, which is fantastic because what we do today is very different to what we did in the mid to late 80s.
You have quite a big group now in Manchester, so could you share us some tips and tricks how you usually try to manage this big amount of people?
Yeah, I'll tell you what my secret is. I hire a lot of really, really good people, At every level, I mean, PhD, postdoc, I have some senior people who've been with me for a number of years, and this is a team effort. Okay, so it's like a pyramid. I sit at the top of the pyramid. I could not do what I do without a lot of senior people in my group, but also postdocs and PhDs who are very, I would say, not only bright and experimentally good, but very committed. And so we work as a family, solving problems, working in teams. And that's the way we do it. And that's turned out to be reasonably successful.
So something very intriguing for me was your continuous focus on similar compound classes, for example, amines. You demonstrated a tremendous variety of biocatalytic systems involving amines. So is this a personal passion, or are these possibilities with this functional group simply so vast that you can do so much stuff with it?
Well, I'll tell you a story. 20 years ago, and this is the story I tell, somebody in the pharmaceutical industry said to me, do you know about 40-45% of the compounds that come through chemical development have got a chiral amine in? So this is quite a while ago, when there weren't all these methods for making chiral amines, either using chemo or biocatalysis. So I thought, you know, that's actually a pretty useful piece of intelligence. So if we develop methods for making chiral amines as well as chiral alcohols, or, you know, they're going to have potentially broad application. And you know, bear in mind, 20 years ago, you know, most of the methods for making chiral amines relied on chemocatalysis. So now we have transaminases, amine oxidases, amine reductases, but that's all relatively recent. And so, and I think biocatalysis has now made a big impact in that area, because, as I said, there are so many target molecules, but there are now many options. And so I think sometimes it's useful to focus on certain things, because, you know, the other thing to think about is that biocatalysis is never a unique technology. There are always alternatives. So you're constantly trying to refine the method that you developed. You know, initially we tried amine oxidases and that was successful, but then in a way it sort of highlights the deficiencies of that method as well. So you think, well, maybe transaminases would be better. And then transaminases come along, and then you think maybe amine reductases are actually the perfect solution, because by this point, you've got so much understanding of what are the advantages and disadvantages. You can really choose your targets very, very carefully.
You commented that you have this pyramid in your working group, and apparently since you are a long time in the field, you saw many researchers come and go. So I just wanted to know from you, what do you think? How much talent, hard work, and maybe luck is required to become a successful researcher? What is the perfect mix, or what makes a researcher great?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you need great students, obviously, and I've been very fortunate to have people who are really excellent at what they do. Again, as I said, we work as teams. So what I mean there is, we also bring chemists together, we bring biologists together, engineers. I think that's really important. You cannot solve problems in this space working on your own as a PhD student. I think that's going to be very, very tough. So we like to, and the students then learn from each other. So if you're a chemist, you can learn all about modeling or molecular biology or protein engineering, and vice versa. And then I genuinely think the opportunities for people who've been trained in biocatalysis are now so sort of broad that this is the best time ever to be working in this field. I mean, again, if I go back and look at my career, 20 years ago, it wasn't so easy to convince people in the chemical industry or in academia to use enzymes. Now the whole situation has completely changed, I think. Biocatalysis has become one of the hottest fields in science. You know, the Nobel Prize to Francis Arnold, fantastic, because that brings it to the world stage. So I think, you know, people of your generation, this is the best time, and it's only going to get better. It really is. There are so many tools I was trying to explain to a colleague of mine the other day, if you look at organic chemistry, the targets and the methodology sort of changes, but what you fundamentally do as a synthetic chemist hasn't really changed in the last 20 or 30 years. You know, you put on a reaction, you work it up, you purify the product, okay, you may be trying to make different molecules. If you think about biocatalysis, if I think about it in my group, the tools that we use now are quite different to the tools we used certainly 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So we don't really clone genes anymore. There's a real example. We just get DNA synthesized by it because we have so many sequences. So about 2 years ago, one of my students, we had a discussion with a company we work with, and they were saying, well, we can create hundreds of enzymes in a week. And she said, well, I've just spent the last 3 months cloning 20 transaminases. And so basically she said, well, I'm not doing that anymore because it just doesn't make sense. So there aren't many fields where you basically fundamentally change the way you do what you do as a result of advances in technology. I think that's quite exciting.
You just mentioned that there are many new tools available, and this is kind of the perfect introduction to my next question. One thing that I see if I read your publications is that you continuously expand your research field to other disciplines. For example, your group recently developed a computational tool for biocatalysis or for biocatalytic retrosynthesis. You're active in biotechnology. You test novel analytical methodology for your screenings. Would you say this is required to be successful in biocatalysis, or is this interest driven? Also, how would you describe your main research focus?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, a lot of it is driven by the people who come into our group. So if you talk about RetroBioCat, which we recently have developed, I couldn't do that. I mean, I have a person in my group who basically developed all of that software and all the tools for doing computer-assisted synthesis planning using biocatalysis. So that is his interest. And two people in our group, that's their interest. So if they didn't want to do that, it wouldn't happen. I mean, I've always seen myself a bit more like a sort of conductor of an orchestra. You know, I know what the sort of tune should sound like, but the way you actually get to the end result is completely dependent on people in my group with specialized skills. I have never cloned a gene for an enzyme. I have never made a library to do directed evolution. I've never done the majority of the experiments that my students do. But that doesn't really matter. You know, as long as you know what the impact of this science is. But it is very, very much driven, certainly in our group, by people coming in and getting interested in certain problems. And then I think what you need to do with young scientists is just put them in this environment where they have the sort of intellectual sort of people around them. They have the equipment, they have the contacts, they have the freedom. I'm completely passionate about that. And then you wait to see where they go with that sort of approach. It has to be driven by them. If I tell them what to do, A, it probably isn't the right thing anyway, and B, you're missing the point of allowing them to be creative, I think, and take the project in the direction that they think is interesting.
I really like your analogy of you being the conductor of an orchestra. Maybe let's switch to one of your other recent works, which describes the identification of more than 300 new immune reductases by metagenomics by taking samples from nature and using an assay for screening. Do you think this will be the way in future to establish enzyme libraries? Also, how did you choose the assay for such a huge screening effort?
Yeah, so I think that's, again, another very good example. This student, who's one of the co-first authors on that paper, joined our group nearly 4 years ago, and he had been trained in the whole idea of using metagenomic sequences to create new enzyme panels. So he was the first person to come into our group with that specific expertise. He'd actually worked with the collaborating company prosomics. So I thought, fantastic, right, so this is our opportunity to learn from him how we do all of this. And essentially that's what we've done. I knew about metagenomics. I knew it was important. There are companies like Brain in Germany who've exploited this, very widely. But this was our opportunity to sort of bring it into our group and see, would it work for us? So he did all the bioinformatics. He produced the enzymes. He manufactured the plates with the company. And then we thought, well, it would be interesting to have a rapid colorimetric screening method, partly because Prosomics had previously developed the so-called K ready to go method for ketoreductase screening. So we thought, well, you must be able to develop a I ready to go version, in principle anyway. But then James worked out how to do all that practically. And then we had a visiting Chinese assistant professor, Pei Yuan, who came along, and those two worked together brilliantly and started to screen the metagenomic library and find really interesting enzymes. And so again, that's how we get into these things. People come with expertise that, allows us to go off in a slightly different direction.
I'm very interested in the concept of biocatalytic retrosynthesis, and you contributed a lot to that, actually. One of the feelings I keep having with this system is that biocatalysis is quite fit in setting up chiral centers or doing functional group interconversions, maybe on a carbon framework that was previously established using conventional synthetic methods. Is this the role of biocatalysis in organic synthesis, or we will soon have tools that also allow building up carbon frameworks or doing connections?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In fact, the future of our CASPTOR retro biocat is to incorporate chemical disconnections, because it's absolutely clear to us that you don't want biocatalysis or retro biocat as a standalone tool. It has to be integrated with chemical tools. In fact, one of the referees, when we submitted the paper, they said, well, can't you just import all these chemical retrosynthesis disconnection tools as well? And we said, well, we need to do this in a sort of stepwise manner. That will come next, because organic chemistry, more traditional organic chemistry, is very good at bond forming processes. There are way, way more bond forming reactions in conventional organic synthesis compared to biocatalysis. We have some reactions, aldolases, etc., but that's what we're working on at the moment. Is so if I give you a relatively complex molecule, the initial disconnections may be more along the lines of traditional synthetic chemistry, and then we're into fragments that are really amenable to biocatalysis. And there are some challenges there, about thinking about what chemical reactions might be compatible with biocatalytic reactions, so that ideally everything would be in water, but that places a lot of constraints on chemical synthesis, whereas everything we do is in water. And in fact, some people have written to us and said that we don't really want to do this. They have said, couldn't we just give them RetroBiocat and they could just incorporate it into their chemical retrosynthesis algorithm? But we don't want to do that quite yet. That's the way the field will go. We will end up with a single platform that gives you options at every stage of chemo or biocatalytic disconnections.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that. Also, another question that maybe targets the future of the field a bit. Biocatalysis seems to come in waves of, let's say, popular topics. There were asymmetric functional group interconversions, like using alcohol dehydrogenases or all kinds of amine-producing enzymes. Then there were cascades. Then now, probably quite popular, is photobiocatalysis. Could you maybe share an advice with our younger audience? What do you expect to be the next big topic?
Yeah, if you knew the answer to that, you'd be in very good shape. Okay, let me. I think a number of things come to mind. I think broadening the chemical reaction space is vital, okay, because that actually keeps the whole field vibrant and energetic. So the day we stop inventing new chemical reactions using biocatalysis, we're not, that's when things are starting to not work out so well. So I think we do need to find more reactions. I'm convinced we will find more reactions because if you look at the number of methodologies that are now poised to target new chemistry, you've got repurposing enzymes, so P450s that can be changed into other types of enzymes for making carbon-carbon bonds, whatever. You've got metagenomics where we can screen almost infinite number of sequences. You've got photobiocatalysis, you'll have electrocatalysis, you'll have all. So all of these technologies ultimately can be brought to bear, I think, on discovering new chemical reactions. And that's really important in my mind because that keeps the field very, very vibrant. And then, of course, you've got all of the technologies around computational modeling of enzymes. And so are we at the stage now, because of recent developments with DeepMind, where it will be really possible to computationally design a catalytically active enzyme with atomic precision? I mean, that presumably will revolutionize what we do. At the moment, we all know that directed evolution is probably our most powerful algorithm for improving enzymes. So we can find them, but essentially we tend to use directed evolution as our go-to method for making enzymes better and better and better, even if they've been designed in silico. But is the next 20 years going to be about gradually phasing out directed evolution and replacing it by in silico design? That would be massive. And so if I was starting again, maybe that's a really a good area to try and get into.
I guess it is, as you mentioned before, it's exciting times to be in biocatalysis.
Okay, let's now go from the future back into history, so into the past. So recently we came across the program of the first biotrans in 1993, which was also held in Graz. You gave there a talk about at this meeting about the synthesis of glycosides. Do you still have some fond memories about the first biotrans in Graz? And what do you think, which things changed over the time, and which things stayed the same at these meetings?
I definitely have very fond memories of 1993 in Graz. That was probably my first big conference. So let me tell you a little bit about that. I think there were about 300 people. Biotrans has now grown to 700, so that's interesting. Herfried Gringel was in charge, and he really. He started Biotrans, so this was quite exciting. There wasn't anything before Biotrans in that sort of scale. So I hadn't really been to many big conferences. This was interesting to go to Graz, famous place, center of biocatalysis. So what do I remember about the conference? I'll tell you what I remember. The first day was entirely devoted to hydrolytic enzymes. Okay. Day two was entirely devoted to dehydrogenases. Okay, by day three, we started to get onto some of the more exotic enzymes like transaminases and aldolases and glycosyl hydrolases. So again, it was a completely different world. I mean, people, there were no talks on directed evolution. I mean, I know people were doing directed evolution in 1993, but it hadn't really permeated the conference scene. So if now it's quite difficult to stand up and talk about lipases at Biotrans. It's not impossible because there's always new things to learn, but we have a completely different conference now, in terms of the science that we talk about. It's if you go back and look at that program, it is. It's almost unrecognizable in terms of what people talked about. As I say, the scale of it was a lot smaller. But Herfried, to his credit, took a, you know, that was a risk. Nobody, you don't know who's going to show up to your conference. Yeah, I mean, especially if it's the first conference. I mean, now it seems a no-brainer to have BioTrans, but in 1993, that was quite an ambitious thing to do. And you can all, you know, it's grown by about 50 or 100 people every couple of years.
You tackled this already a little bit, but some people say that the most interesting reactions found in nature are already exploited in biocatalysis. Would you agree with this, or do you think we will continue to see novel reactions in biocatalysis coming directly from nature? Or will de novo enzyme design and directed evolution be the tools to develop future catalysis?
Well, I sincerely hope we haven't discovered everything because, as I said earlier, the field is going to struggle if the chemistry starts to become limiting. If you look at secondary metabolism, which is not an area we focus on necessarily, but the range of chemistry there is just incredible. And the problem is we don't really know how to use those enzymes, or maybe they're not so active, or maybe they're quite specific for certain substrates. So I honestly don't think we're running out of chemical reactions to work on. You know, what is the best method to find those new biocatalytic reactions? Everything and that you've talked about, I would throw every technique at this that you can possibly think of: enzyme design, enzyme screening, metagenomics, you name it, just try everything, because you probably need a combination of all of those methods to increase the chances of finding new chemical transformations.
Now we come to the next round of questions. I will ask you a couple of questions we kept a secret up to now, and please answer just very spontaneously with the first thing that comes to your mind. And I personally are quite looking forward to your answer to the first question. So, Nick, what is your favorite enzyme or enzyme family?
Well, I have a soft spot for monoamine oxidase because it was the first enzyme we ever engineered. But imine reductases are great. So monoamine oxidases have got a lot, you know, value. But I honestly think with imine reductases, we're just about scratching the surface.
So two enzyme families on the first flip place. What do you expect from a good paper?
Well, most of the very best papers that come out of our group are written by the students and the postdocs themselves. So you probably ought to ask them since they do a lot of the writing, is they do everything. They do the experimental work, they write the papers. The bit that maybe I can help them with is sort of framing the excellent work that they've done in the context of the bigger picture. I think that's something you only learn with experiences, particularly if you want people around the world to read your paper, is how do I explain what I've done in the context of what is going on sort of globally in the area of let's say, synthetic organic chemistry.
What is a scientific no-go for you, either in a paper or in a talk?
Well, we work very, very hard to make sure all of our results are correct and reproducible. And I mean, that's not easy, obviously. We're all challenged by the fact that it's easy sometimes to make mistakes. It's easy to get excited and cut corners. I would say we have a, you know, a very good track record, touch wood, of publishing things that are correct and are reproducible and can be taken up by others. So, you know, clearly a scientific no-go would be if we dropped our standards a little bit and we started publishing things that were not really, you know, completely fully developed, or where we start to make mistakes.
What was the nicest or the worst reviewer comment you ever got?
The nicest was, I think it was one of the papers written by one of my students, where the referee said that the insight he provided into this paper was sort of fantastic. And I didn't write the paper, it was the student who wrote the paper. So I congratulated the student on his on that. The worst, we don't get too many bad reviews, but I think the worst thing that all groups suffer from is when you submit a nice paper and somebody doesn't really read it properly, and you sort of think, oh, that was a bit disappointing, because they sort of they make a few fairly sort of cheap comments about, well, it's all been done before, or et cetera, et cetera. So they haven't really read your paper carefully. And that's disappointing for me, but it's actually more disappointing for the students, I think.
How do you spend your time when you're not thinking about science?
Aha. So I have another passion, which is photography. Oh. I have a blog site, actually. I can give you a link to my blog site. Yep. So my students know this, because I show them the photograph. I spend quite a bit of time when I'm not in the lab photographing wildlife. And I've become really interested. I only took this up 2 years ago. And I started it thinking, well, if it doesn't work out, I can sell the camera and, you know, go back to my day job. But I've become really interested. And actually, photography, there's a lot of parallels between photography and, you know, chemistry. It's sort of one of these things that you start off thinking, well, I'll just, you know, sort of have a go, see how I get on. But you become sort of quite obsessed about it if you're not careful, you know, because you look at your photographs and you think, actually, I could make that photograph better if I, not if I got a better camera, but if I did this or whatever, you know, whatever technique. And so it starts to become the next challenge for me is, you know, trying to take photographs that are as technically good as I can achieve with the equipment I've got. And then and I've taught myself how to make a blog site. I know that's not difficult, but if you're my age, it's quite challenging. So so I put all my photographs up, and then people look at them, and I get nice comments, and I submit them for competitions. And so that's what I do when I'm not.
That sounds amazing, and I'm really interested in that. And I can completely relate to that. I also love photography. So
I tell you what I'm thinking of doing is, I might well try this out in Graz, is putting together a lecture. Don't worry, this is not as bad as it sounds. Is I will intersperse my lecture with my photographs in a way that makes sense. So I will try to use my photographs to illustrate some of the aspects of the lecture.
Just to get it right, you mean for the lecture, for the upcoming Biotrans?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, that'd be great.
I've been thinking about this, and I've been too nervous to do it, but I think at some point I have to take the plunge.
Well, now it's out there. Our podcast listeners know about it.
I know. I've realized I've just committed myself to something, but I've been experimenting with some ideas. So, I mean, you know, fundamentally, one of the reasons I got into this whole area, if I'm honest, is, and I sometimes tell this story, I grew up very close to where Charles Darwin lived.
Yeah.
So that's where I used to go to his house, Down House, and when I was a teenager, and that's sort of how I became interested in this whole issue of natural selection. And so, you know, the things I photograph are all the products of evolution. I mean, that obviously, you know, the flowers, butterflies, birds. So there are strong parallels to be drawn between, you know, what we do in the lab and what I photograph in nature.
Well, Nick, I could continue talking to you for a long time, but at some point we have to stop. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thanks very much. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick, also from my side, and goodbye, everyone.
Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again. Join us also the next time when we meet the next person who will have an invited lecture or a keynote lecture at the Biotrans 2021. And as always, please leave us feedback or questions at the Biotrans Twitter account, or send us just an email.
So, since the last recording, one of my manuscripts was rejected from a high-impact journal. And initially I was very down about it, because, yeah, you put so much effort and so much passion in it. But, you know, when you get rejected from a high-impact journal, you should not become distressed about it. Because eventually, not your work is actually bad, but maybe it just does not fit in the scope of the journal.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons by license, which allows rework and redistribution as long as credit is given and any adaption is licensed under similar terms.